When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Big day. Joe Biden turns 81. Pardons turkeys. Yes, Liberty and Bell both got a presidential pardon, so they will not be on the plate on Thursday. And the right lost their mind on both affairs. He's old. Yeah, we know. The president's old. And the turkeys. And look, you know, as I was watching the right-wing coverage of the turkey pardoning, which I got to tell you, I still think is a stupid thing to do every year. And I say that when Trump did it, I said it when Obama did it. I think it's just a dumb thing to do. But, you know, we've been doing it for so long, it just seems like, well, it's on the calendar. We've got to do something. So, but the right losing their minds over the fact that, you know Joe Biden does struggle with getting some words out. And, you know, that's part of getting older. That's part of his speech problems. It's part of a bunch of things. But it got me thinking, you know, in this era of things to be thankful for, I am not thankful for right-wing media and all of the assaults and the attacks on people. I couldn't help think today, because you go back and you think about the FDR era and what the news media chose to report on back during that time was not his disability. No, they didn't. Big headline: Roosevelt couldn't stand up. They didn't do any of that. They actually, their policy kind of was something important. And what policies are they complaining about today? What do you ask? Are they upset about? Well, my inbox today full of right wing groups telling me that Joe Biden is making Thanksgiving much more expensive. It's all Joe Biden's fault. Now, granted. Thanksgiving dinner this year going to be less than it was last year. Costs have come down. There will be some family savings, and that's a good thing. But they are all upset because out there somewhere, they've been talking about this for a while. This has been one of those things that's been out there for some time. But, you know, Biden is considering a 300% tariff on tin coming into the country. You know, the metal that goes into your corn, the cans of corn, the cans of soup, your cans of beans, your tuna, you know, your canned fruit, your chilies. Yes, all of that going to cost fractions of a penny more than they normally would. But according to them, this is the beginning of the end of Thanksgiving. And I gotta tell you, I kept shaking my head going, this is today's outrage? Is this what the outrage factory? I would like a side of outrage, please. It's like going to a restaurant and the only thing on the menu is outrage. I would like some outrage, please. Can I have a side of outrage with maybe, you know, a little outrage for dessert? That seems to be the the sad reality. Just outrage. So again, today's outrage, you know, Joe Biden is considering putting tariffs on things. And I don't think it's going to happen. But there's part of me that goes, it kind of should. And again, their argument is you know, these are protectionists. And I say, I'm a protectionist. We're all protectionists. You know, when we leave our house, we lock the door, right? I've got a dog. Those are protectionist policies. I'm not an isolationist. I don't have a giant moat around my house filled with alligators with stay out, don't talk to us, go away. I don't have that. But that's what the right, these crazy Joe Biden's going to ruin Thanksgiving by protecting the steel industry in our country because evidently big steel. Do you know that we in this country used to be the world's producer of steel? And there was a time there, and I know it's been a while, but there was a time when we produced the world's steel. And I go back to the bridge in Trenton, New Jersey. Trenton makes the world takes. We now produce about as much steel as the margin of error in the calculation of what the Chinese make in steel. So by saying, you know what, maybe we should protect what little industry we do have. But no, it's big steel. But by protecting what little industry we do have, because, you know, got to tell you, the lesson from World War II, and this sticks in my mind, is that we were able to turn factories that made cars and tin cans and, you know, whatever. We were able to turn those factories into production for the war machine in the event something big and bad happened. And now, look, I'm not a warmonger. I'm not someone who says, hey, let's war up. But I am someone who says, you know, maybe we should have the capacity in the event that someone else. I spent today because, you know, clearly the outrage machine wanted me to know that Joe Biden was going to destroy Thanksgiving by putting tariffs on tin cans. So I spent some time reading the think tank approved focus group tested messaging. And one of those came from a guy named Derek Chevron. David Chevron. David is the president and CEO of the Consumer Brands Association. They're a trade association for America's $2.1 trillion food, beverage, and consumer product industry. $2.1 trillion. And they're worried about the tin can. Fractions of a penny going into making tin cans at home. Now, he's saying, look, this is going to be inflationary. You know, this is not good news. You know, Americans are saying things are bad. And it's the first time since, you know, the Depression that Americans are down on the economy. And his argument is that the tariffs would destroy. Here's what he writes. These tariffs would also devastate those who rely on food pantries to feed themselves and their family. Every year, over 53 million Americans depend on our nation's 60,000 plus food pantries, food banks, and meal programs. Non-perishable canned goods are essential to keeping these efforts running. And, you know, having these tariffs, he argues, you know, just wrong. And I keep coming back to, I'm a big supporter of domestic production for domestic consumption. As I've said before, I think Joe Biden is doing the right thing in moving us in a direction that is reshoring manufacturing. But you have the CEO going, you know, Americans shouldn't have to subsidize multi-billion dollar steel companies at the grocery checkout. I mean, they're so good at that messaging because you go, yeah, why should I have to pay for the steel mill with my food dollars? It's quite remarkable. In that this is the outrage. You know, the headline I read, Biden's new tax could squash my family's can company. And this guy talks about, you know, he's been relying on foreign imports to run his company, and that's where his margin is, by being able to get cheaper foreign products as inputs. And now, we didn't always work like this. That's not how business models were set up. Now, here's the thing. I love the fact that, you know, one of the little headlines was, you know, China doesn't want a trade war, but they'll retaliate. Of course they don't want a trade war because they're holding all the cards now. They were the manufacturer. There were a lot of this stuff is coming from. Now you go, but you know, Rick, only 10% is coming from China. And that might be true. But the conversation is, again, they're saying we should be trading with our partners. And I agree, we trade with our partners. I'm not an isolationist. Again, let me repeat that. I'm not someone who says we slam the doors shut. I am someone that says we should be reevaluating our trade policies. And this is what Joe Biden's doing. This is the reality of what we need to be doing. Evaluating our trade policies and going, you know, do we have foreign competitors who are just dumping and destroying jobs here? Do we have relationships with people where we're both doing better off? Now, understand, there's a lot of people who are complaining about what Biden's doing. I personally think it's important that we have a reset in this country, an industrial policy that moves us towards, again, domestic production for domestic consumption. We build the things we need. The things that we can, we build here at home. And right now you're hearing a lot of voices screaming from within the Democratic Party, you know, Biden should quit. And a lot of them, those are the neoliberals who want us to return back to the good old days. The, you know, those same horrible policies that got us into the mess that Biden's trying to clean up. Yeah, that's where we are. Now, look, do I admit that Biden has a really hard time getting the words out? Yeah, absolutely. There's a struggle there. It's going to be an uphill climb. It's the policies, though, because here's what I know. I know the direction that he is taking us and the legacy that he wants his presidency to be and his memory to be is the guy who reset this country and moved us in a better worker-centric, working-class direction. And I know everyone's, oh, the economy's terrible, everything's down. Dean Baker over at the Center for Economic Policies and Priorities came out with a piece to be thankful for over Thanksgiving. And he points out that, you know, other than Japan, we have the lowest inflation rate of all the major countries. But you've got a right-wing outrage machine here just again, feeding us the outrage. You know, wages have outpaced inflation. Wages right now are higher than prices than they were before the pandemic. That's a reality. Unemployment's been near and below 4% for nearly 2 years now. Got that under control. Black unemployment, historic lows, record employment rates for people with disabilities, you know, record levels of people being satisfied with their jobs. Things are going in the right direction. Health insurance is more affordable now. We've got all this good stuff going on, and yet a right-wing outrage machine that just wants to keep us angry. Outraged. I would like a little aside of outrage with my outrage, please, without actually talking about what direction we should be going as a country. Now, again, I say this all the time. Republicans focus on this is this little nugget, this kernel. We've got this. It's the can of corn to be outraged about today. Don't mind the policy. Don't mind the big picture. Don't mind the job creation and the shift here at home. It's about the outrage right now. Don't think down the road because that's not important. They're good at that. They're good at the hey, over here, the shiny thing. Here, laser pointer. When we should be focusing on the big picture. What kind of a country do we want to have? What kind of an economy do we want? And what kind of an economy do we want to leave for our children? One where, hey, we get cheap stuff. Nobody's got a job. We got cheap stuff. Or one where people actually produce and consume the things that they want and need right here at home. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind. I want to hear it. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Just gotta tell you, I love this. Trump is talking about revamping the RNC. If you continue with those debates, he's gonna revamp the Republican National Committee. And I think that's great. Good for him. Good for him. I hope he does. Today, evidently, released a doctor's note. Yes, Donald Trump got a doctor's note. And a new doctor this time. A guy named Bruce Arnwald. Evidently, Bruce described Trump as his personal physician since 2001. The crazy-looking guy that he had back a while ago. I guess he's gone. What was his name? Buchwald or something? I don't actually remember. But evidently, he is in excellent health. And his cognitive exams were exceptional. He had exceptional cognitive exams. And I got to tell you, I'm seriously questioning that. Because I've watched his speeches. And look, I'm not busting on the guy. I'm just saying, look, you know, there's this exceptional cognitive thing that they keep making a big deal out of. Because they're trying to make this a dividing point between him and Biden. Biden's now 81. Happy birthday, Mr. President. And Trump's, what, 77? So there's not a huge gap. Trump is not, a lot younger. But he does ramble. For instance, he was in Iowa talking about golden showers. And how do you get on that in a presidential speech? Oh, yeah, it was about the tape supposedly from Russia. And he went on this whole spiel where you go, exactly how did you get there? And maybe don't. And it's one of those things where he's talked about it and now made me go, yeah, I don't know, maybe it's true. Who knows? Maybe it's true. And the sad thing is, and we're in such a weird kind of moment. And this is what bothers me. Is that we're in this weird kind of moment where we're not getting anything done. And I go back to what I said a moment ago. Republicans are really good at attacking individuals, really good at attacking things. They've got no policy chops. They've got no agenda for the future. In fact, you ask the average Trump voter, what policies do you want to move forward? Very few of them have any real policy aims. It's all about, we're going to go get Biden. We're going to go after the January 6th commission. Because evidently we're reimagining that now. And there was an interesting article that pointed out that in this Republican House, in this legislative session, the 118th Congress, they are on the path to being the least productive Congress since the Great Depression, since 1931-32. And are you surprised by that? And the answer is no. You go back to the Trump years. There was not an overly productive legislative agenda. All they got through legislatively were tax cuts, because that's all that's really important to them. Lining the pockets of the very wealthy at the expense of of working people. But I look at this and I come back to the fact that they are the least productive. And you go, now remember, these are the people, these are the business folks. These are supposedly the people who, you know, America first, get to work. Speaking of America first, evidently Marjorie Taylor Greene, she has a new book out. Huh? Yeah? New book. I didn't know she could read, but there's a new book out. Now, understand, she is, you know, one of the big supporters of Donald Trump's America First policy. And she's out there pushing for the America First stuff. In fact, she's the founder of the America First Caucus. And, you know, she's called for meaningful work for Americans. She's called for all kinds of stuff. But she's got a new book out. Anyone want to hazard a guess? Yes or no? Was the book printed in the U.S. or not? America First! It's kind of like my Trump supporter friends who have hats made in China. You know, they got the red hats. They didn't buy the official Donald Trump version, but they got the... Because I guess his stuff, the official stuff that you pay through, you know, like $100 for, I guess that's somewhat made in the U.S. I'm not 100% sure. But her books are now printed in Canada. And again, you know, this is the woman who says America First. I love the... Ken Buck, the representative from Colorado, he was quoted by the Washington Post saying that, "I don't think it's possible for MTG to get any more extreme. Maybe more unhinged, but not more extreme." And you know what? Here's the thing. I think Ken Buck is not wrong. And this is one of those moments where you go, you know, see, both sides of the aisle can't agree on something. But this is where I wish that they would have something of a policy. And, you know, with Thanksgiving coming up and the hope that something renewed, something refreshed, that maybe we tell ourselves the story of the first Thanksgiving again, and this brings us together, something to where we actually start talking about how are we going to make working people's lives better. I know, it's really a leap, but I look at this Congress. And with Mike Johnson as the speaker, I don't expect anything different than what we've gotten. In fact, you know, he's now endorsing this some new weird conspiracy around January 6th. So we're going to hear a bunch of that because, you know, there have been more videotapes released, which you can expect, you know, people to spin however they want. But what is going to make working people's lives better? Again, I come back to. The polling says Americans believe the economy is going in the right direction or in the wrong direction. The country's going in the wrong direction because that's all they're spun. That's what the polling says. Do you believe the country's going in the wrong direction? Yes, I do. What have Republicans proposed? And this is where I keep coming back to. Don't listen to the rhetoric. Don't listen to the outrage. Don't buy the candy. Even if they give it to you for free, don't take it. Your parents should have told you that. But what's their agenda? And the answer is they don't have one. You know, don't listen to what they're saying. Don't listen to the outrage, the attention. You know, like any child, they're looking for attention. Look at what they do. The least productive Congress since the Great Depression. And, you know, look, we've had some do-nothing Congresses in my lifetime. We've had some do-nothings there who don't want to govern. These folks truly do not want to govern. They truly do not want. They don't want working people to get ahead. Whether it's, you know, fighting for the corporate interest to ensure that we don't protect our industries here at home, which I am a supporter of, and I've said that a million times. Again, I'm a protectionist, not an isolationist. We trade with our friends. We trade. We're mutually beneficial. But we don't continue to pursue a policy where we buy things that we used to make here only because it's more exploitable labor and more exploitable environmental regulations. We've got a lot of work to do. And Republicans have proven to us time and time again that they are just not willing, interested, able, whatever you want to throw in there. They're just not going to do it. Not at all. And that's troubling.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Now, for quite some time, I've been talking about, you know, my grandparents' generation when they were working. You had unions for every profession. You had waitresses who were unionized. You had sanitation workers. You had truck drivers. You had insurance agents. You had all kinds of professions, all kinds of people who were saying, you know what? We want better wages, hours, conditions. We want better. We want contracts. And look, you know, back when you had 35% union density, you could do this kind of stuff. And look, I think we're in an interesting moment right now. You're seeing Starbucks workers organizing. You're seeing retail workers organizing. You know, I go back to my grandmother, was a cashier for years at a small department store in Cleveland, a member of UFCW Local 880 there in Cleveland. And you know, worked, you know, her 20-some years, retired with dignity, with a pension, with some opportunity. It was, you know, look, it was a good time in this country. And we're now seeing some of that come back. We're now seeing people say, hey, you know what? I want to do better. And that's why I've asked Sabrina Perez to come talk with us. Sabrina is a senior premier banker organizing with the Wells Fargo Workers United Group. She is a bank worker in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And you've got workers in Albuquerque and Bethel, Alaska, organizing at Wells Fargo. This a big, kind of a big deal. So Sabrina, appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much for being here. Tell me, what made you get into this? What made you go, this is what we should be doing, this is where we want to go? What took you in this direction?
So I think, I mean, obviously a combination of those, you know, better pay, better, you know, benefits as far as retirement is concerned, those have been cut back significantly over the past two decades, specifically with Wells Fargo. You know, for a lot of branches, a lot of it is staffing. So as, you know, new CEOs, specifically the most recent, Charlie Scharf has come in, made massive, massive cuts to the staffing models that's impacted our ability to service our communities. And for our branch specifically, that's a huge, huge motivator. And for a lot of other branches that are organizing, it's the same thing.
You know, again, you look at, you know, some of the things that have happened over the years and you go through the pandemic and, you know, we're frontline heroes, you're essential. I'm sure you guys heard all that stuff, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because we were, you know, customer facing. We don't really have the option of going remote or, you know, being a kind of an out of office and still being productive. So we were still, you know, there and doing what we could to kind of work around the pandemic parameters to make sure people were safe. But during that time was when a lot of this these cutbacks started, and they've used it as a justification to kind of continue on as they're increasing those profits and cutting costs.
Now, your coworkers in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and some of your company mates out in Bethel, Alaska, have filed for an NLRB election. Walk me through how the process began with this, because, you know, we've talked with people who go, you know, our industry never had, we don't have unions. Unions aren't something we've been able to get. What made you think you could do this? And walk me through the process of you actually doing it.
So I think that there's obviously a lot of momentum with unions. I mean, you have, you know, SAG-AFTRA, you've got UAW, Teamsters. There's been a lot of, you know, good labor movement lately. And I think that's really encouraging to employees and workers that are in sectors that are not traditionally unionized. You know, the finance industry, I think the figure is around 1% of, you know, of finance workers are unionized. And a lot of that comes from a fear of retaliation or what could, you know, they could close our branches or, you know, whatever the case may be, regardless of whether or not it's legal. That's kind of besides the point. The fear is still there. And so with these new wins, it really did just become more possible, more attainable. And so as we watched this in the news with all these different union wins, it just became something we're like, we got to have some of this. We need it. This industry needs it. And, you know, we're willing to stick our neck out about it.
No, it's something worth fighting for. Now, you know, when I talk to people who have, you know, for the first time, you know, do you have a union background, any union family stuff in your background that would make you, you know, go, hey, this is the way we should go? I mean, for a lot of folks, this is a huge leap, not just, as you pointed out, the risk that go in it, but the uncertainty of knowing what's on the other side. Do you have any background?
So on my dad's side, there is some, you know, background with steelworkers. You know, my grandparents have a background in, you know, the steelworker industry. And so there was a bit of perspective there. It's not my first, you know, kind of exposure to that. But I've always, you know, had an interest. My background for my degree is in politics. And so I have a some might say like a better understanding of how those things work just in general because of my interest in my studies. So for me, that's kind of where a lot of that has started, you know, way back when. But it's always been something where, you know, for a long time, it's just like, you know, things are okay, right? And I think a lot of workers were in that same boat. And it just kind of got to a boiling point where, you know, we realized that nobody was listening. And so that's kind of what spurred us on to looking at other alternatives after exhausting everything within the bank.
Yeah, that's, you know, again, I come back to, you know, it's usually not about wages as much as it's about conditions and treatment. And, you know, because I did some more organizing for a number of years where, again, I come back to it's, you know, it's how people feel they're being treated. And if they feel like they're being disrespected, if they feel like they're not being valued, this is one of those real motivating things to demand respect. And look, wages, hours, and conditions are important as well. But that treatment is almost more important than the other stuff for a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. And for us specifically, I think that, yeah, it really stemmed from this this feeling that, you know, nobody's listening. And there are people that are making these decisions and that have the capacity to change our conditions. And for some reason, it's just like the buck stops at a certain point. And we should be talking to the people that have that capacity. And that's not to disparage the people that are, you know, in our direct line of management. In many ways, they're being squeezed in the same way.
Sure.
But they just don't have the capacity to do so just, you know, with the structure of how unionizing works. So, yeah, we're doing this not only for ourselves, but for people that, you know, are going to benefit from this regardless. You know, lower and middle management are being squeezed in the same way. But somebody's got to take the lead, right?
No, that's extremely important. But to be that person to say, I'm going to be the change that I want to see happen, I give you credit for that. But look, Wells Fargo is a behemoth of a corporation. It's kind of like the people who are taking on Starbucks right now. It seems almost insurmountable. You know, what are you hoping that comes out of this? I mean, you filed for an NLRB election. Do you expect the general kind of union busting that happens in most places where they bring in people to captive audience meetings, harassment, intimidation, firings? Are you expecting any of that stuff? Or do you think it's possible that they could recognize your unit and say, okay, we're going to bargain with you. We're going to make things better. We want everybody at our branch to be happy and focusing on the customers. What are you expecting?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, in a perfect world, we would love for them to take the opportunity to voluntarily recognize the union. We have given them 7 days to do so. So there is that opportunity. And if they choose to take it, I think that it would speak highly for, you know, Charlie Sharp's commitment, so he says, to changing the bank and improving, you know, improving our culture, all of those kinds of things. We are definitely prepared for, you know, retaliation. We are prepared for an intimidation or anti, you know, union or union busting campaign. We have already heard reports. CWA had a big mailing to branches. I think it was like something like 24,000 flyers that went out to each individual member at branches. And we have already heard reports that managers, despite the official line from Wells Fargo of non-interference, you know, intercepting those letters, destroying those letters, retaining them from employees, despite their requests for those once they've noticed that they're there. So I think there's going to be a discrepancy. I think it'll be incumbent upon, you know, those in the labor world, but also in media, to hold Wells Fargo accountable to what they're saying versus what they're doing. And so we're prepared for whatever they might throw at us. But I think that this really is an opportunity for them to demonstrate something different and a different path forward. Beneficial State Bank just had, you know, recently within the last couple of years, their workers file for a union election, and they did choose to voluntarily recognize them. I think that that's the best path forward.
So there is an example here. You wouldn't be the first banking union. That there are some other there are some others out there.
Yeah, so Beneficial State Bank is, you know, a smaller bank, obviously. We would be the first major bank whenever you think of, you know, the big banks.
Right.
This would be the first major bank. But yeah, there's definitely examples out there. And it just kind of goes to show that this method can work. And you can, you know, you can get further by working with your employees than trying to stifle them. It really is an opportunity that Wells Fargo really is being handed because, you know, they've had enough bad press over the last several years, decade. And this is an opportunity for them to maybe, you know, squeak out a win.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Sabrina Perez. She's a senior premier banker. She's organizing with Wells Fargo's Workers United. You can check out their website, betterbanks.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that, betterbanks.org, the website. Now, again, I come back to, you know, whenever you see a strike, whenever you see something going on, it's important that all the workers are standing in solidarity. But it's also important that the community stands in solidarity. So for me, this is an opportunity for folks to join my Adopt a Striker or an Organizer campaign and get involved in this. What can I do? What can our listeners do? What can people do to help say, hey, you know what, Wells Fargo, you know, honor these folks' requests, honor their rights, treat them with dignity and respect. What can folks do?
So I think that there's a lot of different things that, you know, just everyday people can do, acts of solidarity. I mean, even if you're just a Wells Fargo client, you know, you have the ability to give feedback on every transaction that you perform with the bank. This is an opportunity for you to communicate, hey, I think you should respect workers' rights to organize. You know, you should implement non-interference and make sure that you're not doing any kind of intimidation. I think that's a huge thing from the public. And I think that public pressure and, you know, media scrutiny will be the difference between how they react and how they are acting.
Yeah, I mean, you got to shine light on things. Because, look, I want all workers to be empowered to do the right thing. And look, you know, Wells Fargo got themselves into some trouble several years back. And I don't want you to get into those waters. But the reality is an empowered workforce maybe solves some of those problems and doesn't let them get into those kind of situations. And I say this all the time, having an empowered workforce saves the company from itself sometimes. And I think this could be one of those scenarios.
Yeah, absolutely. Even just to be able to address issues, you know, at a higher level before they get out of control, and hold some accountability, you know, on every level. I think that, you know, unionized companies, you know, can often run more efficiently, more productively, you know, more profitably. So I think if you're working with your employees, happy employees, you know, are a lot more productive than unhappy ones. So, you know, we're really trying to, you know, I've said this several times, that we're trying to bring, you know, some of the community back to community banking. And that's kind of what Wells Fargo has tried to, you know, sell themselves on as a community bank. And, you know, we really can't do that if we're not investing in the communities that we're a part of.
Yeah, you might actually get me to put some of my money in a bank. I use credit unions because, you know, overwhelmingly credit unions are, you know, from my view, much more responsive to customers. Maybe this could be a way Wells Fargo gets someone like me back in their doors make sure that their workers have decent wages, hours, conditions, and a voice. But ultimately, you know, when you come back to this, and this is where I kind of want to wrap this up, is, you know, you want to ensure that the work that you do is compensated fairly, that you get, you know, some seniority rights, that you're not at will employees. There's a lot of this of saying, look, this is just being a working person in this country and having a bit of security and an ability to support our families. I think that's a simple message as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think basic dignity, basic, you know, livable wage, be able to support your family and retire with some dignity. I don't think that's a lot to ask, especially with a company of this size.
I'm right there with you. Sabrina, I appreciate you taking some time with us. By all means, please come back and keep us up to date on how things are progressing, because I want to keep an eye on this.
Definitely, Rick. Thank you so much for having me on. Have a good night.
Thanks so much, Sabrina Perez. I want to hear your thoughts. Would a unionized bank, would that be something to get you in their doors? Would that be something that you think is important? I do. I'm going to take a quick break, right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1888. That was the day that William LeGrand Bundy is credited with inventing something that has become a daily part of life for millions of workers. His time recorder was a time clock that could record when workers arrived and left their jobs each day. The clock would record the time on a paper tape when a worker inserted his or her individualized numbered key. Bundy was a jeweler and an inventor from New York. After inventing his time clock, he went into business with his brother Harlow and founded the Bundy Manufacturing Company. With the growth of factories, there was more and more demand for time clocks. They were considered more exact and efficient than human timekeeping. Keeping track of hours worked and labor costs became an essential part of squeezing every drop of profit out of the industrial workforce. The Bundy brothers located their company in the city of Binghamton in southern New York. Business thrived. Other inventors put their own twist on the time clock. At the turn of the 20th century, the Bundy Company merged with several other timekeeping outfits, forming the International Time Recorder Company. Workers across the United States, Canada, and Europe had their work hours recorded by international time clocks. Later, the company became part of International Business Machines, or IBM, one of the worldwide leaders in workplace technology. Over the years, new innovations have been introduced to employee timekeeping, such as time cards and computer-linked swipe cards. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So evidently, Monsanto got themselves in a little bit of trouble. Fourth straight loss for Bayer. Roundup, the chemical Roundup. Evidently, they've again, lost another round of lawsuits. This time, a woman from New York, a guy from Missouri, and another guy from California were awarded $61.1 million in compensatory damages, $500 million each in punitive damages because, you know, they each was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And, you know, they're saying the cause, this chemical, which, you know, evidently there have been studies that, you know, this glyphosate is safe for human consumption. And look, I've been hearing for years that not. The sad reality is we let these big companies do these kind of things. And you have to wonder. I keep going back to this swinging door between government and corporate interests. I keep going back to the lobbying that goes on and the kind of policy making, that revolving door of people going from industry back to government, back to industry, back to government. For instance, Ron Klain is now the guy who was Biden's chief of staff. He's going to be the chief legal guy over at Airbnb. It's that kind of stuff that's... And look, is it new? No, it's not. But again, we're going back towards monopoly again. You've got these big companies who are doing these things and ultimately not being held liable for them on the big picture. This is a lot of money for a couple of people. And trust me, on appeal, when this goes down the road, the $500 million in punitive damages, that's going to be reduced to a pittance. And we've seen this before because you see I always love hearing people say, well, you know, that woman burnt herself with coffee. She got a gazillion dollars. No, what she got at the end of it is pretty much what she asked for, which was just to pay the medical bills. and some of her costs. Now, the award was enormous. Upon appeal, reduced. And for me, I come back to this stuff that, you know, you look at these big companies who pollute, who put out products that are harmful. They push and they lobby and they do all kinds of stuff to get these things approved. And then they go and they hurt people. Lots of people. And, you know, there's a slap on the wrist. Don't do it again. Now, I don't want to be one of those people go, well, you know, you're killing everybody. No, I'm not saying that. But there's some research being done out there that says, you know, this stuff isn't good for us. And I go back to a government of, for, and by we the people. Why do we have regulators who continually allow this stuff to happen? Because businesses, they've got huge, large pockets with lots of lobbying opportunities and lots of ability to get what they want done. This is my concern in this. So, but I saw the lawsuit. I'm going, yeah, all right. You know, let's throw this out there. Let's quick go to Steve on line one. Steve, what's on your mind, buddy?
Hello.
Yeah, what's on your mind, Steve?
Yeah, so I wanted to make a couple of points, and by and large, echoing what you were already saying, I mean, you've got a system that's rigged against the average American and by and large, people around the world. I mean, yes, you hear about the crazy stories, you know, that somebody got X amount of money in a verdict of such and such, you know, judgment. Okay, yeah, but as you point out, yeah, that gets appealed to no end, and then of course, you know, a lot of people are forced to sort of settle for something far less. Otherwise, you know, it's okay. You might get your money 20 years from now. So, you know, if somebody's mistreating your mother in a nursing home, well, okay, you know, you don't want to wait 20 years. I mean, she's going to be long gone by the time you see anything, as opposed to getting something now so that you can help take care of her.
Yep.
And the reality is that this country was built by a lot of people who decided to, you know, take advantage of other individuals, everything from permanently damaging them in terms of the accidents that happen, the things that chemicals can do to us, and the degradation of our environment. I mean, you name it. And then in the end, you know, the way that things are structured in this country, you know, you can make billions, and then because it's a limited liability corporation, you know, once you've taken everything that's worth anything out of XYZ area or whatever, you know, the company dissolves and you leave the taxpayers with a giant hole in the ground, or in many cases, something toxic that they have to then pay to fix, or, you know, to make safe again. I mean, you know, this whole notion about balance just doesn't exist. You know, the people who are making the money are not paying for the cost of what's called externalities,
right,
in this society. And again, you know, that's because, as you point out, you know, it's a rigged system. My brother, he works with a company, and they basically bring some of the biggest names in politics and big business to the stage to do speaking events and so forth. And yeah, I mean, you'd be amazed at what people who used to be in government make. You know, they're no longer, nobody talks about their names anymore, but hey, they're making 50, 80 grand, 100 grand to appear at some convention and to talk for a couple of minutes, you know, to do X, Y, and Z lobbying, you know. So, I mean, it's not quid pro quo, but, you know, when you're trying to get something passed and you go and talk to a congressman or senator and say, yeah, you know, we'd really appreciate whatever you can do for us on this. You know, it's good for the country, it's good for your state. And, you know, I mean, we're really impressed with a guy like you. You know, that's we all know what that means.
I had a friend who was in Congress, in fact, from Illinois, who said, look, nobody's ever bought my vote. But they get my ear 15 minutes at a time when I ask them for donations to help me run for re-election. So I hear their message over and over. They didn't buy my vote, but they got my ear.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, you know, when it comes time to that, you decide that a few hundred thousand dollars a year, you know, isn't very much money, you know, and you're ready to leave office. Well, yeah, you know, then it's everything flies under the radar because people like to keep it very quiet as to who they went to work for. You know, but if you do a little bit of digging, you find out that people who made some of the major decisions in this country with regard to past legislation are miraculously working for companies that were directly involved in that legislation.
Yeah, I mean, we had a vice president who was the head of a war machine. So,
yeah,
there is that. I appreciate the thoughts, though, Steve. Thank you so much. No, look, you know, like Steve said, you'd be amazed at where some of these politicians end up and what they get for, an hour speech. It's really remarkable, the kind of money that corporate America throws around. But you know what? They're going to fight you tooth and nail if you want a better wages. And I think about, the person we just talked to, Sabrina Perez, we just talked to, going up against a behemoth like Wells Fargo. What do you think that they're going to throw at those poor workers? If they really want to, what kind of intimidation and harassment do you think is coming their way? Because our labor laws are so badly broken. And this is a giant corporation who could easily afford, the couple of pennies more in wages, the little bit better health care, could easily do it, but won't. Because they don't want to, they don't have to, and it would send a bad message. Makes you wonder where we are. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I came across a really troubling story. And look, we've seen a lot of these horrible, horrible stories coming out of prisons throughout the South, especially. I think it was Mississippi where you had the one guy that, big guy, he was like 230, 240 pounds, that they literally starved to death. Got him down to like 80, 90 pounds. I mean, it was just horrible. And, we see this stuff, too frequently. So I saw this story of an Alabama guard, corrections officer going, hey, prisoners, I don't like that guy over there. He's causing a headache. Take him out and I'll protect you. Kind of frightening, scary stuff. That's why I've asked Michael Sonato to come share some thoughts on us. He's a labor reporter over at The Guardian US. Michael, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
So walk me through this story. I mean, this again, we keep hearing this kind of stuff popping up where you've got these corrections officers, you've got these people doing some really vile, horrible stuff. This kind of fits into that vile and horrible.
Yeah, so to give like context of the state of Alabama's prisons, they're currently being sued by the Department of Justice. That case is scheduled to start next year because of how inhumane the conditions are. The accusations in that case are that they're violating the U.S. Constitution. They're very overcrowded. They're very understaffed. They're, the deadliest prisons in the U.S. They've had record deaths in their prisons, last year. It's on pace the same year. So it's just all around and just things not getting fixed. And instead, the state of Alabama is spending a ton of money defending the state in this case. About a decade ago, Alabama defunded their mental hospitals, and that kind of contributed to an influx into the prison system that's just not designed to handle it. They're very old buildings. They're not designed to hold as many people as they are. I did a story earlier this year. Prisoner was posting videos on TikTok just depicting, showing prisoners with just debilitating healthcare issues that just were not getting treated, or they were just basically getting a Band-Aid and told to go away when, it's just like really just harrowing, just things you would not, one wouldn't expect to be allowed in this country. And that's just the kind of the modus operandi in Alabama's prison. So with this case, Robert Earl Council, I don't, for people that don't know, last year in September and October, throughout in different prisons in Alabama, the prisoners went on strike. They stopped doing their prison jobs to demand that their conditions be improved, that, you know, the prisoners who need our required health care actually start to receive it. One of the organizers, one of the main organizers of that was Robert Earl Council. So, you know, I talked to him back then just about the state of the prisons. And, you know, recently, over the summer, he helped fellow prisoners file some lawsuits, particularly against the correctional officers. And one of the correctional officers that had encouraged other prisoners to take him out, you know, were listed in these lawsuits. You know, one testimony from another prisoner was that he was brought into disciplinary hearing. He accused that correctional officer of fabricating the whole thing, and his response was to punch him in the face and break his jaw. So that kind of behavior. There have been several COs that have been arrested in Alabama for, you know, just smuggling in drugs or, you know, committing crimes or, you know, using just the kind of disarray of the state of the prisons to their benefit. And in many cases, that leads to harm. I mean, just today, there was another story. A 22-year-old was supposed to get out of prison. He was in prison for a year. He wound up dead. It's in CNN. And that was at the behest of, you know, the correctional officers that contributed to that. And it's just like really just disgusting details. And it just seems like they're just letting these prisons worsen in condition because, you know, they lose this trial at the end of next year. The federal government will take control of the Alabama prison system. And it seems like they're confined to the fact that they're at least not willing to put any sort of funding to, you know, clear out their prison system and to kind of provide the basic, you know, conditions that they're required to do.
Yeah, but you're going to have people, you know, Michael, who are going to say, you know, prison's not supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be a punishment, Michael. This isn't Club Med.
Well, there's a big difference from cruel and unusual punishment, which is against the, you know, violates the U.S. Constitution, which is what these prisons in Alabama,
like starving
are,
someone to death, would be cruel and unusual.
Absolutely. So, you know, you have to have people's basic needs met, and you know, in humanity, there's obviously a lot wrong with our incarceration system in the U.S. We're the world's prison capital. We have, you know, the highest prison rate. You know, it's just all across the metrics. You know, ridiculous. We're one of the only wealthy countries that still use the death penalty. Alabama still uses it. And, you know, it's you know, segregated for the conservative states that don't put, you know, the funding where these conditions are the worst are the ones that are, you know, still practicing that. You know, another issue is privatizing services and privatizing prisons. You know, private prisons have been.
Yeah, that's all over the country. You know, that's in every state. But let me ask you about the corrections officer, this Jeremy Pelzer, who, you know, evidently there is a federal lawsuit. It's going on. Are there any criminal charges against this guy? I mean, ultimately, if this is what he did, if this is he tried to get this guy murdered, shouldn't there be some kind of a crime? Shouldn't Jeremy be one of the folks that he's supposed to be protecting and keeping an eye on?
That's what, you know, that's part of what the lawsuit's trying to get, you know, and those things are up to prosecutors in Alabama to, you know, gather the evidence, listen to the evidence and, you know, file those charges. Right. And It takes a lot to get to that point.
Prosecutors in Alabama, you had me. You had me there. Going, okay, that's hopeless. Wow. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Michael Sonato. He's a labor reporter over at The Guardian. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at what he has put out. I got to get your thoughts on a couple other stories that have popped up. You know, here on the program, we've had some Amazon drivers on talking about trying to organize Amazon drivers and, you know, make that job better. I saw a video of Richard Sherman, NFL vice president and NFL Players Association vice president, kind of palling around with and having a high old time with some Amazon drivers. It made it actually look like a fun job, even though I know actual Amazon drivers who tell the stories of having to go to the bathroom in bottles because they got to keep their time going, who are constantly being harassed and pushed to do more and more. Didn't look like anything that Richard Sherman was seeing. Thoughts on the NFL Players Association's VP out there palling around with the union busting Amazon?
I would like to hear them try to explain it or at least respond to it, because, you know, when I saw that, it was really surprising because, I covered the Alabama Bessemer Amazon election, the first one, and the NFL Players Association endorsed that campaign. That election is still under review. It's not certified. It's not closed down. That, you know, the NLRB ordered a rerun of the election. The votes didn't turn out in the workers' favor, but there are still challenge votes that are determinative. There are still objections to the rerun election that have to be adjudicated by the board, and that's going to happen over the next year. So that election's still up in the air. That's not settled. The one in Albany is still not settled. And the Staten Island one, the NLRB regional director denied Amazon's objections to it, but they're still doing an appeal. So, there's over 200 unfair labor practices that have been opened or are settled. There were national settlements at Amazon. And then when you get to the drivers, there's a big disconnect because Amazon will tell you they don't employ their drivers. But, you know, they certainly didn't make this distinction when Richard Sherman was driving for them. They're just not saying, oh, he's not actually driving for Amazon. He's driving for this contractor that has nothing to do with us. But when it comes to these workers that unionized in Palmdale, California, that's the case. These workers unionized, they were fired in June, and since then they've been picketing and they've been holding walkouts they'll get in touch with, you know, whatever Amazon facility around the country, and they'll, you know, participate in a walkout. So workers in that facility will walk out and join the drivers for Amazon with the Teamsters at pickets, and they've been over, you know, 20 different warehouses around the country. I think outside of Chicago is the most recent one just this week. So they're still putting pressure on Amazon to recognize that union, recognize the contract that they agreed upon with the contractors. And Amazon's defense is that they blaming it on the contractor when it's like, okay, even if that was the case, let's say that, why would you fire these drivers? Why, if you're not against, if the workers have the right to unionize, they did, why would you not honor that? You know, I'm sure it's not the first time that these contractors have changed. So really, it's just up to them, and they're not, explaining their decision, and they're not taking responsibility for the power they have to say, we're not dealing with this contractor anymore, but you are unionized, you've done the job for years. Many of these drivers have been working for Amazon for several years, and they've talked about the same conditions that I've heard and other reporters have reported on, for years, the peeing in bottles, the getting rushed to do quotas, the heat issues, air conditioning, then the van's not working, the low pay, which is, for people, you know, comparing it to UPS, it's just that you're getting paid a fraction for, you know, the same amount of work, and you're delivering to, you know, 250 to, you know, upwards of 500 different places during this time of the year when peak season and the holidays are coming out. So it's it'll be interesting to see how that pans out, and how these different union elections and union organizing efforts that have been stymied by Amazon's opposition, how the labor board decides on these things, and how that impacts you know, future organizing efforts at Amazon.
No, you're absolutely right. And one of the reasons, again, I keep coming back to, the reason I want Biden to be reelected in 24, because you change that, the composition of that National Labor Relations Board, all of this organizing gets much, much more difficult. Got to get your thoughts on the big three, the UAW members ratifying the contracts. It's a good thing, right?
It's a good thing, but, you know, that 60% and change ratification, that's not great. UPS, I think, was around 80%. So, I've seen explanations that it was due to the high expectations that workers had for this contract. So, it's much better than what they've gotten in previous contracts.
It's enormously than what they've gotten. And, I mean, it's not even close to what they've gotten in previous contracts recently. I mean, it is, you know, I was looking, someone sent me a copy of it. I'm going, this is much better than I thought they were going to get on the outset. So, you know, when you say that expectations were high, how much higher do you think they were?
Well, from what I've seen from people that have explained their reasons for voting no, I think they were looking, for more in terms of the pay. I think the concessions that these workers have taken on in recent decades were just so big that it's, this contract doesn't make up for that.
No,
this contract is a good start to getting on the road to making up for that. Certainly, and it's certainly miles ahead of what we've seen from the United Auto Workers, and we've seen every other car company has been raising their wages to kind of stymie off any union organizing attempts from the UAW. That in recent years, the Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, is a recent example. That was a close vote. But we'll see if they pick up things like that and are able to show this is what we want for our union workers. And
if they want the kind of wages, if they want the kind of increases that the expectations that you're talking about, you got to organize all the other companies as well. You got to have density in the industry to boost all wages in the industry. At least that's how I see it. But, Michael, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Hope folks will check out your work, labor reporter over at The Guardian U.S. You can also check out his Substack page, thelaborreport.substack.com. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Michael Sonato, appreciate the time, man.
Thanks, Rick.
As always, great stuff. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Let's quick go to the phones. We got Alice on line one. Alice, how are we doing today?
Semi-coherent. So what I wanted to say was this. Do we expect anything else from the southern states in particular when it comes to the way they run their prisons and their jails?
No.
You know, if you look back, and we go back to the Civil War and right after the Civil War going into Reconstruction, they were renting out
convict lease programs,
and then, I mean, in the 60s, they called it the chain gangs and stuff. And this is going on down there for, you know, well over a century and a half, and probably longer.
No, I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, the fact of the matter is they used convict labor to break a lot of labor strikes, you know, especially in the coal mining industry. You know, Tennessee was front and foremost in that whole thing. Grundy County, as I remember, was the big place for a lot of this. And look, we're back to it. I mean, they're using prison labor to do all kinds of jobs. And, you know, this person that Michael Sonato wrote about was someone who said, hey, we don't have to put up with this. He filed a bunch of lawsuits, organized strike. And you know, for his trouble, you know, you get a prison guard who wants to off him. I want to know why the guy's not, you know, at least in jail or heading towards jail while this is just a civil lawsuit.
Because I guess I want to say that the red counties, and I'm including mine, which is up north,
yeah,
it's that good old boy network where, you know, if you're in the same political system and you have the same political beliefs, then nothing happens. I mean, the district attorney or whatever or whatnot doesn't do anything. And I've seen it happen here in my own little rural county here in Pennsylvania. So it's just surprising to me. Well, I guess it's not. Let's just say it's so hypocritical that the same people that are screaming about, you know, crime and criminals and following the Constitution and being law-abiding are the same ones that's not following any of it. But I guess, what do you expect? Yeah. Have a good evening, Rick.
Thanks, Alice. Appreciate it. No, I mean, you know, the reality is, you know, and again, I'm glad she brought up the convict lease programs. You know, we have for a very long time incarcerated people and used them as cheap labor. And I look at it's no state's immune. You know, I remember while the wildfires were going on out in California, you know, a couple of the, you know, the outposts that were manned by prisoners paid like, you know, like 50 cents an hour to do dangerous, you know, life threatening firefighting work. You know, didn't get as much attention as you would think it should. But we do this in this country. We have a for-profit prison industry that, you know, they got to figure out how to squeeze every nickel, squeeze every penny out of someone's misery. And isn't that, you know, a lot of what we see happen in corporate America? Let's figure out how we can abuse, you know, people's misery, and then of course profit from it. Sad. And look, and you hear these stories, and the sad thing is Alice is right. You know, in a lot of these places, it's just, you go along, get along. You know, it happens. Yeah, he's a bad guy. Yeah, it's a prison. Prisons are supposed to be dangerous places. It's because they're criminals, after all. I just, you know, I can't get the image of the guy. Actually, I think it was Arkansas now that I'm thinking about it. It was Arkansas. The guy was 230 pounds when he went to jail. And when he died, they weighed him at like 80 pounds. They literally starved him to death in solitary confinement. And we now know that solitary
you know, putting anyone in solitary confinement is horrible for their mental health. And then add on top of that that they probably had mental problems to begin with. You're only magnifying that. You know, our prison systems are supposed to be about rehabilitation, not retribution. And yet, retribution seems to be all that, that we can think about. And look, you know, we put more people in prison for, you know, really dumb stuff. Look, violent criminals, rapists, murderers, absolutely. You lock them up. But a lot of these low-level drug crimes, a lot of the, I don't know. But again, if you look at the for-profit prison contracts, 85% occupancy demands. You think any hotel in this country would love to have a contract that says 85% of heads in beds? You bet your behind they would. Right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Maria Bartiromo. I remember the first time I heard her name. Joey Ramone had done a song about her on his final album, you know, right as he was dying of leukemia. He sang about her because she was like the business reporter. So she would give all the financial news. Now she's turned into kind of, crazy. floated the idea today that the Chinese released the COVID virus on purpose. Just saying, is it possible? It's possible that they deliberately COVIDed the world just to get rid of Donald Trump. That's the theory. That is now coming out of Fox Business. And remember when Fox Business talked about business? Remember that? No, but this is where we're going. Get ready for it. We're going to get a lot of January 6th. We're going to get a lot of COVID. We're going to get a lot of crazy between now and election because, as I said earlier, Republicans don't have an agenda. They have no policy aims. They have no way of making your lives better. It's just about the outrage. And here to share some thoughts on, well, maybe Maria Bartiromo is on to something. Maybe it's possible. That's why I've asked my good friend Bob Ney to come share some thoughts with us. Bob's a former Ohio congressman and political analyst. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
So what do you think? Is it possible the Chinese did it on purpose just to get Donald Trump, you know, as retribution against the tariffs?
I don't think so. Now, I do think the Chinese wanted rid of him. I mean, no doubt in my mind, because Trump, you know, the one thing that we've talked about that, you know, he definitely needs to be recognized for is that he took the Chinese to task, which nobody in modern times has done. And of course, Biden's kept the tariffs, which, yep, you know, has been a good leverage point. But I don't think China did the virus to get him. I do believe that China worked on the virus in the lab, knew of the virus, et cetera. And that I think when they were to dispose of the animals, I think somebody got them out and sold them on the wet market. I mean, that's kind of as close as I get to conspiracy theories. But
no, that's where my mind has always been. Yeah, because, China's, you know, completely. At the end of it, when they released it, they actually got it much worse than we have. They've actually suffered, right, much more from it than, right, we have.
And it's like anything. They're doing lab experiments. There's no doubt. You know, they tried to, you know, eventually keep it quiet. They didn't think it was, you know, they thought they could contain it. But I think, and I've had friends that have had this theory, not crazy friends, but D.C. friends. But I think that they were to dispose of animals that they tested and that they worked on and experimented on. And look, you know, some Chinese worker making 15 cents an hour was, you know, told, hey, bring these to the wet market. They're worth a lot of money. And, you know, a couple of them went out. So, but I don't think they did it to intentionally inflict it on their own population because they've had trouble since, yeah, this. And they didn't do it to get rid of Donald Trump. I don't think they wanted Donald Trump, but I think that's too sophisticated.
Yeah, well, it is that, but it's also
their own people.
It is a bit extreme. We're going to cause a global pandemic. Now, again, you go, well, how did they know that they were going to cause a global pandemic? They obviously didn't. But by releasing it into their own backyard,
right,
I don't know. I can see if it just hit us. I could see that if they put it in the baby formula, like the melamine, or you know, the dog food, like the melamine that was killing, you know, dogs and kids. You know,
lead,
maybe I could see that.
Lead paint on toys. They did that. Yeah.
Maybe.
Right.
Yeah. But here's what I've been saying for a while. It's the outrage candy. And the outrage is we got to relitigate COVID, and now you got Mike Lee going back after some crazy stuff. I guess Ray Epps is now popular again. We're going to relitigate January 6th. You got Marjorie Trainwreck Greene calling for a new select committee of people who are going to this time, you know, tell the truth. Any thoughts?
Well, you know, the video that's being released is, well, first of all, we've had enough, you know, January 6th had a committee. Having another January 6th committee is not going to verify or codify that these were just tourists, you know, wanting to just see the Capitol. And then I saw some of the footage where somebody was trying to climb up the wall, tear gas came in, and the guy, his face was cut, and he's like, look what they've done to us. I was just standing out here. Yeah, out where you're not supposed to be with a crowd of, you know, thousands of people. And you weren't supposed to be up near the Capitol like that. But releasing this footage now, pieces are going to be taken. I'll tell you another thing, too. They keep showing this footage of these guys with the, you know, Trump flags walking very calmly right past the door. And I know that door well in the Senate. And what also happened was some people were in the Capitol. Police were up the rotunda. They didn't know who had automatic weapons or not. These people didn't go through screeners. They went through breaking glass windows. And nobody was about to start a firefight in a rotunda.
Yeah.
So if they had a scene perception here because of the video that it looked calm, the officers were trying to remain calm so that they basically wouldn't be killed.
Yeah. It's called de-escalating a situation. Something a lot of policemen... Something a lot of policemen should learn from.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what happened in the Capitol. And now they're taking, although I must say, I don't disagree with Johnson, the Speaker Johnson, releasing the material because, look, McCarthy released the material to one guy.
Yeah.
Why? Because he knew what Tucker Carlson would do with it.
He knew how he'd spin it. Right.
Yeah, which was outrageous. So if you're going to release it to one, yeah, release it to everybody. That part I don't quibble with.
No.
But people are going to take pieces of this thing, and there is nothing to investigate. It's done. The police were not, you know, taking people on tours. So you know, Marjorie, she just needs to, I don't know, find something else to...
Maybe they should have participated in the first select committee, and then maybe we would have gotten both sides. We would have gotten the pro, the con, the in, the out, the back, the forth. Maybe we would have gotten an actual defense from them. Yeah. Maybe. But the problem is they didn't want any part of that.
Well, and there is no defense because these were people who broke into the Capitol, and if somebody broke through a door or broke through a window and you followed them, you're culpable. You know,
exactly.
you break into the front door of the post office and I follow you in. I can, I was just following Rick after he broke the door down. No, you know, I'm culpable for it. And I'll tell you this, if this had been the White House, and I'll just throw this out here, and these people were coming over the fence, what does anybody think would have happened?
Yeah, they'd have gunned them down.
They'd have gunned them down.
Yep.
Exactly.
No question
exactly.
about it.
Exactly. Without a doubt.
You know, as I was, you know, you were just talking here. I was remembering Elizabeth from Knoxville. Do you remember that the meme that was going on about her?
No,
she was this woman who evidently she was in the Capitol. She had claimed she had been tear gassed. She was crying and her eyes were all in. And they go, "What'd you do? Who are you?" She, "I'm Elizabeth from Knoxville, Tennessee." And you know, they just tear gassed me. And they go, "What'd you do?" "We're storming the Capitol. It's a revolution." And I'm going, "You know, yeah, this was the mindset of the people who were there that day."
Right, and then the other thing is about the woman who was shot. Those doors. If you go through those doors she was trying to get through, and again, they don't know if they're armed, they've got weapons, they don't know. And if you go through those doors, you are literally 2.5 feet away from the door where you go in, where the speaker and the members are.
You know,
literally that close.
I've watched that video a couple of times, and what's surprising to me is that, you know, for all this talk of, you know, oh, we care about her, nobody in that crowd went to help her.
No.
Nobody in that crowd went to her side. It was the Capitol Police. It looked like a Secret Service person. It looked like someone in a suit, you know, with an earpiece. It looked like someone who worked there. They immediately went to her aid.
Well, and here's the thing. Getting in the Capitol is one thing. Going through the rotunda in the building is another. When you go through that door where she was shot, and I've been through that door thousands of times, when you go through that door, you go 2 feet, you're on the floor of the House. The members were up in the gallery hiding. I don't know if the vice president was on the floor at the time, but members were, and that's where the speaker's rostrum is. Yeah, you're going to get shot.
Yeah.
Yes, you are. Because now it's one thing down, you know, in the rotunda doing these things. It's another when you're about to go onto the floor of the House. And who knew if she had an automatic weapon or not? No one knew. You know,
no.
Best way to not get shot trying to breach the floor of the House is don't breach the floor of the House.
There's the answer. And the thing is, I keep coming back to the very simple truth. What was the rally about? What was the theme of the rally? Stop the certification
of the election. And the vice president can do it, and he's down there in the Capitol.
Yep. Everybody went there with the intention of, we're going to stop the certification of that election. Now, a good number of them were not going to go into the Capitol. They weren't going to commit crimes. But the ones who did, they're the ones who should be held accountable. And some of them have been.
Let me ask this, too. Let's say, you know, let's rewind history and create it ourselves with the hypothetical that they breached the floor, got a hold of Pence, and hung him. Then what would the charges be on everybody that said, Pence is down there at the Capitol?
Yeah, he's hanging.
Yeah, he can stop it. He's down there. Then what's the charges?
Well, yep. maybe Trump, maybe the Speaker of the House does do, well, no, the Speaker would have been Nancy Pelosi. She wouldn't have caved. But who knows? Maybe they'd have hung her.
I'm just saying that, you know, then there's a conspiracy of murder.
Wow. Yeah,
culpability.
I don't want to go there because, you know, we were very close to that, weren't we?
Right. Well, the one guy had the ties, you know. The wrist ties.
Yeah.
What were they going to do with that?
Yeah, you get those zip ties on. They were going to.
They were going to zip tie some books for the Congress. You know, to keep them together.
They're going to zip tie their pants together so they don't
wow.
defecate on the floor.
Wow.
I mean, that's out of all of the things, and this is, I guess, it just shows where my mind goes. Out of all of the things that went on that day, someone defecating on the floor of the Capitol. That just, how do you? How does that come to mind? How do you go, you know what? I think I'm going to drop trout right here in the middle of the hallway and bang, I'm going to leave a present.
Yeah.
And then I think about the poor guy who had to go and clean that mess up.
Right. Exactly.
I don't know. It's just, right. You know, but these are the very best people.
But they're just
tourists.
They're just tourists. That's all.
I got to tell you, as a tourist, I've never taken a dump in the middle of the room. Exactly.
Or taking zip ties into the Capitol.
I gotta change topics. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Bob Nay, former Ohio congressman and political analyst. Gotta get your thoughts on the Eighth Circuit's evidently their decision to basically gut the Voting Rights Act. Evidently, the claim, as I understand this, is that private citizens and civil rights groups and individuals can't sue under this, only the federal government can. Is that how this goes?
Yeah, they had a 2-1 decision, and it was the Eighth Circuit, which is the Court of Appeals, and they actually acted on a lower court ruling. So it went from the lower court to the Court of Appeals that private citizens and also advocacy groups, which would include the NAACP, for example, and other groups, that those groups would be precluded from bringing lawsuits under a provision that in itself stops discrimination in state and local election laws. So basically, the appeals court decision would limit and could and probably would limit the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act is what would happen. And because the appeals court is saying that the big key part of this act can only be enforced by the attorney general themselves, all right? And then that goes back to some kind of, I don't pretend to understand all of this, but some decision in a year ago, and that dismissed Arkansas's district map because they said the Justice Department has to join the plaintiffs if you want a decision. So bottom line of that whole thing I went through was that you'd have to have justice directly intervene in order for any of these to be questioned is the way I read it. So groups wouldn't have no power. NAACP individuals would have no power to enforce in the sense of filing motions on the Voting Rights Act.
And as I understand, you've got Gorsuch and Thomas who have supported this idea. So the question is are there three more on the court, on the Supreme Court, that would go along with this? And for me, I look at this not as, you know, as a racial issue. I go, look at it, you know, it doesn't matter who you are. You know, what do you do if you've been denied the right to vote? If this is the case, and there are ways to preclude people from voting, what remedy do people have? Because at some point, you know, they keep telling us, the majority is going to be the minority. So these kind of things you might want to keep around. At least that's where my thinking goes.
Right. And if you look at the decisions, the judges even noted this. In 40 years, there have been over 180 successful cases that have been filed, and 15 were just filed only by the attorney general. So I guess what I'm reading from that, the rest of the cases couldn't have been filed if this decision was out there. Jeez. This is eliminating individual people's right, basically. Yep. To sue under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And that runs contrary to anything that we've had in our existing law for 40 years or anything when it comes to fair actions where a group or an individual can make a motion. Now, just because they make a motion doesn't mean that that's it. You know, it has to be decided, of course. But the way this is going to read, the AG themselves will only have the jurisdiction to do that. You know?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where our Supreme Court comes down on this.
Because it's going to affect, eight or nine states only in their jurisdiction. So it's going to have to kick up to the Supreme Court.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see where the Roberts Court takes us.
Right.
Finally, I got to get your thoughts on the passing of Rosalynn Carter. Carter. I got to tell you, I woke up today expecting to hear that President Carter had passed. Because, you know, when you're together that long and the stories that I've read over the years of, you know, couples who are that close for that long, it isn't long. So, you know, for me, you know, sadly, you know, every day now I'm going to be watching for that. But any thoughts on the former First Lady?
Right. And I thought the same thing. And my parents were married 76 years, and then my mother passed and my father passed, you know. And when you're together that long, there's, you know, a lot of influence on the heart. But even Donald Trump wrote a beautiful piece on Rosalynn Carter, you know, or somebody wrote it for him. But the fact he released something nice on her. And I've had a fortunate opportunity to meet her and Jimmy Carter. And then Jimmy Carter set up the Ford Carter Commission, which led to us, Steny Hoyer and I and Chris Dodd and McConnell, being able to do the Help America Vote Act. The Carters are just wonderful people. Anybody would have, I think, a political disagreement with Carter over the whole Iran issue, you know, et cetera, foreign policy. I think even if they have that disagreement, they have to appreciate the Carters as human beings. They're just amazing, for real people. I was fortunate enough to, you know, to meet both of them. And they're just two of the most genuine people, kind, you can meet. I met them under the auspices of Habitat for Humanity. She did a lot of mental health work as First Lady when he was governor and as First Lady for the country. Genuine people, great people, and a lot of good thoughts are going to go her way and also towards Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, no, again, it's sad to see, and, you know, but, you know, the lives that they led,
Oh, amazing.
Just amazing. But I appreciate the thoughts, Bob. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our good friend Bob Ney. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me at rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1816. That was the day the Albany Typographical Society used the term scab to describe a strikebreaker. The word scab had been used in England for nearly three centuries as a slang, meaning a rascal or scoundrel. By the late 1700s, laborers began to use the insult to refer to workmen who wouldn't join a union or a strike. In the United States, the early 1800s were a time of organization among skilled workers, especially in cities in the Northeast. Cordwainers, or shoemakers, were one early group of organized craftsmen. Cordwainers who chose not to join the workers' associations were viewed with contempt as scabs. A Philadelphia cordwainer during a court trial in 1806 defined a scab as a shelter for lice. The Albany Typographical Society is largely credited for being the first organization to use the term scab in print to define a strikebreaker. Company owners have long tried to replace striking workers with scabs. In 1886, scabs replaced striking workers at the McCormick Reaper Works in Chicago. Police fired on the anti-scab demonstration outside the plant, which led to the Haymarket tragedy. The National Labor Relations Act, passed in 1935, attempted to make such strikebreaking illegal, but a 1938 Supreme Court decision created an opening for bringing in scab replacement workers. Perhaps the best definition of a scab is thought to come from the popular author Jack London, who wrote, "After God had finished the rattlesnake, the toad, the vampire, he had some awful substance left, with which he made the scab. Judas Iscariot was a gentleman compared to a scab. For betraying his master, he had character enough to hang himself. A scab has not." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So, here's a shocker. You know the Moms for Liberty group, you know, or as I call them, Maniacs for Misery? Evidently, a pastor and leader of the Philadelphia Moms for Liberty group, evidently he has been exposed as a registered sex offender. Are you surprised? That was my first response. I saw the story. I'm going, am I surprised by any of this? And the answer is no. Evidently, Philip Fisher Jr., a pastor and faith-based outreach leader for the group's local chapter, was convicted in 2012 for aggravated sexual abuse of a 14-year-old child. Evidently, he was 25 and living in Chicago at the time, and now he is a pastor in Philadelphia. Huh. Now, what's interesting is, you know, you go back and you look at the Maniacs for Misery and some of the things that they've been advocating for, you know, kind of makes you go, he's the kind of person you should be keeping children away from. And yet somehow, he's right there in your ranks, you know, out there banning those books because, hey, you know, we want to keep kids stupid. We want to keep kids vulnerable. You surprised by it? The answer is no. None of this is ever all that surprising. And for me, I look at what's going on, especially with these kind of groups and the people that they attract. It's not about what's best for the kids. It's not about what's best for their education, for the future of the country. It's about none of those things. It's about their power and their control. It's about their ego. It's about what they get out of it. And I've met people over the years who participate in these groups, and it really becomes, so it's about them. It's not about the issue. They could care less about the kids. And certainly could care less about education. And I would argue a lot of them are on the privatization bandwagon or on someone's payroll. And for me, that's where a lot of this stuff kind of breaks down for me. When I look at these folks who are advocating for a particular position, it always seems to come back to, we need to break down public education. We need to privatize it. Give it back to religion. You know, pastors. Maybe not the sex abuser kind of pastors. But there does seem to be a lot of them. Just saying. Just kind of throwing that out there. As someone who went to Catholic school. Yeah, there I said it. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Subscribe as we are ticking down our final days live radio. We will be continuing doing an hour daily program on many of our affiliate stations, but those will be in the recorded format. But the podcast is always available, always there for you. Never miss a moment. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.